before there was BTS, before Psy's Gangnam Style, there was a handful of people trying to bring the Korean wave to the United States. Their work was the foundation upon which Korean entertainment content exploded onto the scene in the United States in the past few years. Our guest today has been promoting Korean pop culture in the United States for over 20 years, carefully monitoring the cultural and technological trends that helped and hindered the business side of the Korean wave. His story is one of patience, learning, and ultimately success. If you missed our first two episodes with this year's Korean American Day honorees, Susan Kang, founder of the cultural trendsetting website Soompi, and skincare entrepreneurs Charlotte and Dave Cho, we highly recommend you go back and listen. From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. Michael Hong is the CEO and co-founder of Digital Media Rights, a leading global distributor of digital-first content, including movies, television programs, and documentaries. With his company's relationship with leading digital platforms, including Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, Google Play, and others, it's very possible that Michael is single-handedly responsible for the chores that you missed last weekend because you were marathon streaming a new hit. Prior to forming Digital Media Rights, Mr. Hong was co-founder and CEO of Imagine Asia Entertainment, which included Imagine Asian TV, the first nationally distributed Asian American cable network in the United States. It's no exaggeration that his work made American audiences more familiar with Asian media content. This year, we're honoring him on Korean American Day for his contributions. Congratulations, and thank you for being with us on Korean Context. Maybe we can start with your background. Where did you grow up, and were you a big consumer of Asian entertainment content when you were growing up?
I would say pretty emphatically no. I grew up in Queens, New York, and it was when I was growing up as a Korean American, it was probably not a good idea to point to my Koreanness to survive kind of in the inner city. So I think I've always been conflicted about that, and even the fact that you know, I wasn't that familiar with the language. That probably played a part in it. But, yeah, I mean, I was just trying very hard to fit in. Yeah, so I would say that my interest in Asian culture and Korean content developed as I got older and older. And, you know, in the lifespan of my career's work, I would say that it was the latter half that I really kind of jumped into it with the formation of Imagine Asian Entertainment that really kind of reintroduced me to Korean content. And it's been probably one of the most gratifying things. But, you know, everybody's kind of journey is different. And my journey definitely didn't happen immediately. I grew up wanting to be, you know, an artist and a filmmaker. I probably got into Asian culture with, you know, Japanese cinema, with Kurosawa and people like that. And I didn't realize how good Korean filmmakers were until I started getting into it. So, yeah, that's a long answer. But basically, it took a while for me to kind of embrace it.
And it started with, as you said, when you actually got mm-hmm. forming and working with Imagine Asia Entertainment, mm-hmm. Which you founded in 2003. Could you set the scene for the audience? I mean, in 2003, we're talking about anime is in the United States. Mm-hmm. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out mm-hmm. a couple of years before that. But what was the exposure of Asian entertainment in the U.S. market like when you founded Imagine Asia?
Yeah, that was such a different climate. Compared to what I'm doing now, it really does feel like I was swimming upstream. There was really no business climate. It was supposed to be kind of like the BET for Asian Americans. We quickly found out that there aren't enough single focus that would unite Asian Americans because we're so diverse. You know, anytime somebody comes to me and says, look, would you rather create an Asian business or would you rather create a Chinese or Korean-American business, I would definitely point to the latter because, to me, it feels like a real market. At the time that I was launching that, probably, you know, the startup cost for something like that would be, you know, $200 million. We just, you know, we kind of bootstrapped it. And, you know, toward the end, I think we did end up raising close to like $30, $40 million, but it just wasn't enough. And so eventually we had to sell to CJ, which is a Korean studio. And now they've taken the distribution and basically rebranded at Mnet, which is a famous, obviously, Korean music channel. But yeah, it was an incredibly instructive process for me. I learned a lot about the Asian media market. And I also realized that it probably wasn't the right vehicle to approach Asian content. So it was a learning process. And I think where I am now with a digital approach to capturing this market is probably much more feasible. We had, at Imagination's peak, we had 65 full-time employees trying to launch and sustain, you know, one linear cable channel. I run probably 4 owned and operated digital channels now and manage probably a network of 60 digital channels on the advertising side with 19 people. So that's the difference. At that point, we were really kind of pioneers. In addition to the TV network, we had 2 movie theaters, one in New York and one in LA. It was really about trying to create a sustainable distribution system that you can not just have the one-off hit with Crouching Tiger, like you mentioned. It was about, is it going to take the next step? And is there enough of a market? I think with the Asian market and with the Korean market in general, you can't just rely on the core audience. There needs to be this kind of buy-in from the mainstream, at least from a big enough percentage of the mainstream that has interest in that. You can't be like BET or Telemundo, right? Those markets, like Telemundo, there's literally zero crossover. Obviously, the language is a huge barrier. But even if they did subtitle everything, there's a big enough Latino audience to sustain that business. Same thing with BET, not with Asian. Because, you know, culturally, socially, we're so different. So it's quite difficult. But I think there's probably different ways that we can approach, you know, for instance, the growing interest in Korean content.
It sounds like, at least in 2003, when you started this, the audience that was most demanding of Korean content or Chinese content were Korean Americans and Chinese Americans themselves within the United States. Has that changed? It sounds like it's still nascent. Is that an accurate depiction of where a demand for Asian content is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a little confusion in the beginning about, you know, who the audience was for a channel like that. I would say there needs to be content that really resonates beyond that core audience because, I mean, BTS is a good example of that. The people that are fueling the craze for that is really white suburban girls, teenage girls in America that's fueling that. There aren't enough Korean Americans, you know, for them to get invited into these award shows and things like that and for them to kind of get the YouTube numbers that you see. The interesting thing to think about is, like, how did they do that? You know, what were the precursors? If they had done that 10 years ago, would it have been feasible when I was starting Imagination? No, because I had a similar type of experience with Rain, who was like the biggest thing in Asia at the time. I mean, in some ways, he was probably a bigger in Korea because he was just head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of popularity. And then we did this really extensive thing with him in the U.S. that kind of exposed K-pop for the first time in a meaningful way.
Right, the concert at Madison Square
Garden. Yeah, we were very, very involved with that and the publicity and getting the New York Times article, which was a cover story in the Arts and Leisure section in the New York Times, which led to him being included in the Time 100. You don't know where the inflection point is, but I feel like we did pay our dues with K-pop. And, you know, certainly at that point, but there were a lot of barriers, I would say.
Could you give us an example? Was it language
was it. Language, you know, at the time, you know, we worked with JYP quite a bit. And the guy's really ahead of his time. He was trying to lay the groundwork for this, even probably 2-3 years before Rain kind of dropped in the U.S. And you can kind of see that. He was building classes and schools outside of Korea. You know, his kind of regimen for his students were really on point in terms of interviews and learning foreign languages. So all of that really helps. But then there are other factors. If I had to say anything really made a difference, it's not even so much on the content side. It was really on the distribution side. Mm-hmm. So before, when you had 4 networks and even before that 3 networks, there's no chance in hell that anything outside of really established kind of Hollywood type programming would work. All of a sudden, YouTube just changed everything. Psy is a YouTube phenomenon.
Right, right.
didn't have YouTube being as big in the year of rain. And so when that happened, that just exponentially accelerated. And also, all of this is being fueled by youth culture. Mm-hmm. The people that are embracing this and making BTS into a mainstream thing, I mean, obviously, they didn't catch on to that on established television or media outlets. They picked it up on YouTube. I mean, YouTube really created BTS. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no way that TV channels, entertainment shows were going to entertain K-pop. It was really from the bottom up. People just didn't know who they were and, you know, what the appeal of K-pop was.
Right.
K-pop also brought something really interesting to the table in combination with the digital landscape, which was the fact that unlike Western kind of content, when a K-pop music video launches or drops, there's this kind of expectation. It's such an engaging community. What makes K-pop special, I mean, they do a good job just on the product itself, certainly getting better and better and better. But, you know, what makes it special is that there's this reaction culture. So as soon as a music video drops, you get literally thousands and maybe millions of people doing cover videos, reaction videos, dance cover videos. Now, what that does is it's great that people kind of get engaged. And, you know, in some ways, you know, they're saying that, wow, we really like this stuff. But what changes is the minute somebody puts a camera on themselves and uploads it into a bigger community, all of a sudden, it's not really about BTS anymore. It's about the army. Mm. And it's about them personally. And all of a sudden, they have skin in the game. And it's like, oh, my God, you're so cute in this video. Or how did you learn that dance so fast? Yeah, it's not. It just changes the entire dynamic. Mm. And K-pop probably does that better than anybody else.
Why is that? You're capturing some of the very interesting components of K-pop. It's very unique in having collected the community. And you're absolutely right in your observation that there's a lot more engagement from the K-pop community. Yeah. With the content than any other pop culture phenomenon. But why is that? Why is
it
that?
It started out with dance. Mm-hmm. And I can go back to like the Wonder Girls, literally. It happened in Korea. You know, what you do is a song comes out and everybody kind of dances to it. In the beginning, the dances weren't that hard. That's the whole idea behind Gangnam Style. It's the ajimas and the middle-aged ladies that made that into a huge hit. Like, they're like, oh, that's so cute. And I want to dance to that also. It happened domestically in Korea first. And then people started realizing and started to copy it and upload it. If you really want to know what it is about K-pop that elicits this type of emotion and engagement, the best thing to do is look at YouTube reaction videos. And I never watch, let's say, Korean or Asian reactions. I always like to watch Western reactions. You know, I like to watch one of my favorite YouTube channels for K-pop is like Hillbillies React to K-pop or Sorority Girls React to K-pop. What you find is this very interesting thing that happens. Anytime a music video happens, there's usually about maybe a dozen key points that they like about that video. It could be the boy's look. It could be the girl's look, fashion. But these are the same kind of themes that they mention every single time in very disparate type of reactions. So that should tell you something. Like people from Brazil, people from, you know, France, they go, oh, that hair or that hat. I mean, they constantly. It's almost like a checkbox. You have 12 checklists in this video. This video succeeds on X, Y, Z. And literally, a lot of the people that react to that, it's like, oh, she forgot this one. Because they're all reacting to some of the very kind of interesting things that, A, are in some cases very similar to Western pop, but in other ways, very, very unique to K-pop. And what's nice about it is, for the most part, the themes that people acknowledge and point to, they're mostly very positive. So one of the big things on the negative side that people point to sometimes is there is kind of a, you know, where they mention like some of maybe homophobic areas that they see. And there is some disconnect there with Western audiences. But in other matters, and this is more kind of a mixed bag, you know, how effeminate boy bands look versus Western acts. I would say most cases, the teenage girls here actually respond positively to that because it is so different. And they're almost fascinated by how Koreans feel about kind of men interacting with each other or young teens interacting with each other. And they embrace that difference. And they're like, oh, that's so cute. I really kind of appreciate that. And that's something that they can't get from Western culture. And so there are a lot of these themes that come up. You know, in the beginning, I think initial people's reaction is, oh, my God, they're wearing makeup. It starts from there. But the fact that they're different is really what sells it. The fact that BTS is not like the typical boy groups in the West. The other thing that people respond to is, and these are like very kind of Confucian ideals that are played out. Like the whole idea of juniors and seniors and how that whole dynamic works, they're fascinated by that. And that's why I always tell like Korean producers or Asian producers in general is like, do not go crazy, especially in the digital climate. Do not go crazy trying to copy Hollywood because that is a disaster waiting to happen. The very thing that people respond to is the fact that it's culturally distinct and different. The only reason why anime became like probably the biggest mainstream crossover to date is the fact that it's not Disney. Americans, culturally speaking, they will absorb everything in the golden age of Hollywood when they realize, hey, these European guys, they know how to make films. They just brought them over and absorbed it. And so what Hollywood does typically is they try to copy it first. So the only kind of genres that have kind of broken through are anime because they just, you need a sensibility that they don't have. Martial arts, they've tried, but they can't do it better than Hong Kong. And now maybe K-pop, right? Or Korean dramas. So you got to bring something to the table that is different. Otherwise, they're going to just buy the remake rights, which is what they tried to do. They obviously make a mess of it. You know, they made Old Boy. They made a lot of other things that they didn't realize. It wasn't about the story. You know, it was the artistry and there was a lot to it. But that's what they'll do is they'll try to buy it. They'll try to buy the remake rights and they put American cast and put it out there, and there's certain things that are just, you can't do that. And the thing about Psy is, yeah, it's very commercial, but it's very distinctly Korean. That's what made it special. That's the part that I think Koreans really, really, really have to get. You got to stay true to what you're bringing to the table.
And here, as much as we've emphasized the importance of social media and of YouTube, obviously, there is a critical role played by the aggregators and the original people who bring the content from the Asian market to the United States,
absolutely,
such
yeah.
as yourself. What are some of the principles that you set down when you founded Digital Media Rights and when you're looking for Asian content to bring to, you know, the broader American platforms?
I mean, one of the things that I think I'm most proud of, and it happened fairly early on, was when we sold, I think we sold about 220 films to Netflix. I think we literally doubled or tripled their Asian category at that time. This was a while back. And most of those were Korean films. I would say probably 65% were Korean films. We wanted to bring to the table good quality commercial films that mainstream audiences would see and go, okay, I'm going to try another one of those. They were pretty good. I do think that the rise of Korean films started there in terms of kind of mainstream acceptance. So many people watched classics like My Sassy Girl and things like that. They were really kind of iconic rom-coms from Korea. I would say that most of those films that were submitted to Netflix, they were previously rejected. Okay, so to me, it's really about understanding the market, packaging it in a way and say, look, these aren't 200 discrete films. We made a real strong argument. We had a really good partner on the other side who was actually a Japanese-American executive and said, look, this is about addressing, and this is kind of an argument that we made, this is about the 5% of the Asian-American audience that you can start to properly address. And we made a, you know, I think a social, political argument, and it just, as a group, it worked. It's about trying to leverage that. And I think we did that really well. We didn't get rich from it, but it really kind of started the ball. And I would say on Amazon, we have by far the biggest Korean film library. We work with all the studios in Korea. And we've aggregated not just the most obvious genres like action martial arts, or which is really the stuff that used to work only, or I would say genre films in general, horror films. We've expanded that tremendously. And we probably have over 300 plus Korean feature films, and most of them very, very good films.
Is there anyone in particular that you want to highlight as, I mean, maybe one that surprised you in terms of its success in the U.S. market?
Yeah, you know, it's really strange how things develop. To be absolutely honest, you're probably more dependent on the algorithms of Amazon. You know, it could be a word in the title that kind of takes it to a different level. But for whatever reason, I'm most proud of films that really didn't see the light of day. We have this one film, and it's not the greatest of its genre, but it's a solid film. It's like My Royal Tailor or something. That was a nothing for most people. And that was a huge hit on Amazon. I think probably well over 100,000 people watched that film.
Oh, that's the period drama, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Again, it's not a masterpiece, but the main point that I was getting at is in terms of more traditional dramas and rom-coms and period pieces, there was really no audience for that. And I would say films of that type that used to make like maybe $50, $75, $100 a month on Amazon, they're now 10 times that. You know, you got to create critical mass, I think. You know, somebody tries, and luckily, you know, for us on the Korean side, the quality is fantastic. Koreans are like, in some ways, in terms of commercial filmmaking, they are the best in Asia, okay? And we just have a lot more of that stuff for people to go, oh, I know that actor now, and it kind of mushrooms that way. But you need a certain critical mass, I think, for that to happen. And now I think there is this appetite between the movies and the dramas. They're now starting to identify with celebrities and with actors and with talent. And I would say that having the right partnership is important. I'll give you an example on the Chinese side. Like, there's a huge artist in China. His name is Chris Wu. He actually started out from EXO, the K-pop group. And then he's one of the kind of infamous members that left. And then he became literally one of the biggest Chinese stars. That happened to everybody that left EXO. They became huge stars in China. But even he has a hard time penetrating the U.S. market, which is what everybody wants. You need really strong partnerships that really understand the U.S. market and also sees the potential in what you bring to the table. And then really try to find, and I think there's going to be a lot of that continuing to happen. The really exciting thing, though, is I'm pretty sure most American companies, they're going to mess it up. But in the end, I think what's going to happen are going to be the real success stories in the more, let's say, less famous platforms. The media is tremendously fragmented, but you can pop out and go viral if you have the right content. And then all of a sudden, you become a big deal. Even without these big projects, all of a sudden, you could actually be a big star. And more of those things are going to happen. Facebook is going to be enormously impactful for everybody. I advise Chinese companies a lot, and I want to kind of redirect their attention, is stop investing so much money in the studios. You need to invest in Facebook and projects that are really geared toward that. The future is post-millennial audience. That's the future. And where do they watch? You know, one of the first words my kids ever learned, iPad. Literally. I'm not really proud of that, but that's the window into the world for them. So don't keep betting on the same models, right? I mean, that's what people are doing.
I think we heard like an amazing story. I think you were someone who was there who watched essentially the American market not be aware of, I mean, forget the Korean content, any Asian content was a...
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story. When Rain was coming and he was in Madison Square Garden, 90, 95% of the audience were Korean. But the Korean media, they tried so hard to just look for anybody that wasn't Korean. And it was hilarious. At that point, Hallyu wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't. It is a real phenomenon now.
Right.
And it's amazing, like you said, to kind of see the evolution of that.
You talked about how you didn't feel comfortable identifying as Korean-American growing up in Queens. How has all this made you feel about yourself and, I guess, the larger Korean-American community in the United States?
I have four kids. The idea that for them, that they can really kind of embrace their Koreanness, I'd like to say I played a small little part in that. I used to tell people all the time, like, the minute somebody came to, let's say, a Korean kid, the minute, like, their white friends or black friends came to them and said, hey, you know, did you see that on Imagination TV? Like, that's so cool. Like, that would be the definition of success. And that's what it's about. It's about the kids and the fact that they could now take that idea, let's say an anime program or let's say K-pop, and say, you know, you don't even have to say it directly. It's like, yeah, that's who I'm about. I'm part of that. And I think when that happens, that's really what I would like to see more and more of. And it's just the pride that comes with it. And I think that's really what's so gratifying about it. It's the window into kind of connecting to people outside of the Korean community. I'm seeing that happen. But there are some challenges moving forward, no doubt. And I do think the biggest challenge is China. You could be the most popular act. You do one thing. I don't know if people have been following what happened with D&G in China. It literally one PR trip. And same thing happened with K-pop too, with Twice and with the Taiwanese girl who basically had a flag. It was very innocuous. And all of a sudden, Twice is pretty much dead in China. They apologized. It's done. So they're focusing on Japan, right, outside of Korea. But that's what I mean. You know, overnight, China's like, okay, we're going to cut Korean content now. And so no matter how amazing it is, yeah, one policy decision could just kill it. And when you kill it on the Chinese side, you're basically killing it for the rest of the world. Because how much of the investment is coming from China? Right, right. So, I mean, I worry about that. But at the same time, there's the U.S. market. And Netflix is spending enormous amount of money on Korean dramas and Korean movies right now. So, yeah, there's definitely some, you know, obstacles and I would say challenges moving forward. But, you know, ultimately, I'm very optimistic about Hallyu.
That's it for the episode today. Many thanks to Michael Hong and to you, listeners, for tuning in. The incident that Michael spoke about towards the end of the episode involved a Taiwanese member of the K-pop girl group Twice, who was pictured holding a Taiwanese flag in the group picture and faced a massive backlash from audiences in the People's Republic of China. Michael also spoke a bit after the interview about the unofficial boycott that Korean cultural products faced following Korea's deployment of anti-ballistic missile defense system, which Beijing saw as a threat. Our program will return next week. Until then, please visit our website at keia.org for videos of our latest events and tweet at us at KOREAECONINST. See you next week.